Cuba reported no cases of COVID-19 this week. Success comes with small invasions of privacy. Instead of you going to get tested, government officials come to your home.
They knock the door and they ask if there is anyone with fever or flu symptoms.
One of the cruelest parts of this pandemic, families can't properly say goodbye, leaving a backlog of emotions.
We can really expect that there is going to be a tsunami of suffering.
Also, stuck at home and sick of your view? Swap it out.
What you think is a boring view will be something that someone across the world will find endlessly fascinating.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Glad to have you with us today. A quick glance at infection rates around the globe shows us Latin America now leading the planet in coronavirus cases. One success story in the region, Cuba. Cuban officials have not reported any new COVID-19 deaths for 2 weeks. Overall in Cuba, just 87 fatalities since the pandemic began. Even Cuba's fiercest critics admit things are going well there. But there's also something else going on. Like the U.S., Cuba is seeing a grassroots movement to combat police brutality. The pandemic is only making matters more complicated. Here's The World's Joyce Hackle to get us started.
Ever since the pandemic began, many Cubans have been starting their day by watching a press conference on TV. It's led by Francisco Duran, a silver-haired physician and Cuba's chief epidemiologist. On a recent morning, he shared some good news.
Podemos decir que no tuvimos ningún fallecido en el día de ayer.
We didn't have any new deaths yesterday from the virus, he says. Havana residents like Liber Puente, he's a tech entrepreneur, look to Duran for guidance and relief every morning.
People really believe and follow his advice and news every day. He talks like a common Cuban doctor, and that for Cubans is very important.
Duran's message is clear, and so are the government's orders to fight COVID-19. One of the directives is that residents should welcome the healthcare workers who show up at their homes. Tens of thousands of medical students, doctors, and nurses have been going door to door to take temperatures and try to spot the coronavirus cases before they spread.
They knock the door and they try to talk with an adult and they ask if there is anyone with fever or flu symptoms.
If someone tests positive, there's quick action.
If the person is declared positive, then they are taken to a center for people who have been treated.
In Cuba, these house calls aren't unusual. It's how the island has tackled other viral outbreaks like dengue fever. The country also has lots of doctors, one of the highest ratios in the world. Colin Lafferty says a medical student shows up at his door several times a week. He runs a travel company from his home in Havana and studies U.S.-Cuba relations. He says no one in Cuba is second-guessing its coronavirus strategy.
Things that have become debates in other places in the world, like whether you should wear masks, what that means for your freedom, you know, whether people should be tested or they should remain at home or be treated, you know, none of those things were debatable.
Not wearing a mask in public can mean jail time in Cuba. One case, which was televised, featured a young man who'd been stopped by police twice for not wearing a mask. Here he is pleading for his freedom before a judge. He's saying he didn't want to infect anybody. He didn't want to spread the virus. But the judge didn't buy it. She sentenced him to a year in prison, citing laws enacted to prevent the spread of the coronavirus. And now, political dissidents in Cuba say these very same laws are also being used to persecute critics of the government. Tanya Bruguera is a well-known activist and artist in Cuba.
There have been cases where members of the opposition who have the mask, but maybe they take the mask for a second to smoke or something, and it almost feels like they're waiting for them to do that because immediately they come and they put them in prison because they have wrongly the mask.
Bruguera says activists like her have faced increased harassment since the pandemic began. But she says in recent months, government critics have still managed to pry open new space for protest. That's partly because during the pandemic, Cubans stuck in their homes increasingly turned to social media to express themselves. I spoke with Bruguera via WhatsApp.
Social media has become the most feared space for the government because they cannot completely control it.
This all came to a head in June, Bruguera says. That's when police shot a young man, Hernandez Galeano, in the back. Police say he was running away from a robbery. Others say authorities were trying to stop him for not wearing a mask. Galeano was black, and some are calling the case Cuba's George Floyd moment. Hernandez's aunt posted a photo of her nephew in a coffin on Facebook. She demanded justice. Activists like Bruguera were stunned by the response.
This small post put by somebody nobody knew, it became so viral that the government could not ignore it anymore and had to talk about it on the news. And this was really the first time that we saw something like that. It was incredible, it was intense, and the whole Cuba knew that there was some police abuse.
Cubans are increasingly using their phones to film police abuse despite the pandemic and the stepped-up police authority. This Facebook post from June shows a crowd shouting down a policeman who's grabbed a man by the neck in downtown Havana. Activists say the man was criticizing the government when he was apprehended. Bruguera herself was detained by police just a few weeks ago on her way to a protest. She's unfazed. It's happened to her many times before. And now she says there are many more protests happening in Cuba on the streets and online.
I think we're living a very special time where activists are actually winning and in a way imposing or forcing the government to become democratic.
But whether these protests become more widespread or sputter out depends on a few things, including whether Cuba's economy can spring back post-pandemic. Right now, many Cubans, including Liber Puente, the tech entrepreneur, just seem happy their businesses are still running and that Cuban doctors have beaten back the virus, at least for now.
I think they have done the best they could have managed the situation. Very few things could have been done better.
Gratitude like that could wear thin, and the rifts exposed by the pandemic and by the activism challenging police brutality could force a deeper reckoning with those who've called the shots in Cuba for decades. For The World, I'm Joyce Hackel.
So Cuba seems to have the coronavirus under control, but a lot of the world continues to struggle. In the past 6 weeks, the number of cases worldwide has roughly doubled in 6 weeks. For many of us, hope lies in finding a vaccine. With me to talk about the latest vaccine research and efforts to ramp up production is The World's global health correspondent, Alana Gordon. Alana, this week, phase three trials started in the U.S. for one of the leading vaccine contenders. What does that mean, phase three trials?
So the biotech Moderna with the National Institutes of Health has started this phase three trial. And what that means is they're scaling up testing of the vaccine in people, recruiting some like 30,000 people where some get a placebo, some don't. Because at this point, you don't really know if the vaccine approach that's been developed in the lab and in these smaller scale phases, whether that actually works. You also have to figure out how the dose works and side effects.
And this company, Moderna, it's not the only candidate.
No, definitely not. There's an Oxford trial with AstraZeneca that's already been in phase three. That's being tested in the UK, South Africa, and Brazil. Marco, overall, there's like two dozen vaccines in human trials at this point. Governments are placing their bets in some of these front runners to try to get that vaccine available. Because let's say you figure out something works, you don't have the time or space in a pandemic to then be like, okay, let's start figuring out how to scale this up.
So what does that all mean for access as people are like predicting when a vaccine is going to be ready so they can make it?
The conversations around access are happening right now, and they're complicated and they're full of ethical issues. I talked to Moncef Slaoui about this. He's the chief advisor for Operation Warp Speed. It's this new U.S. government program. It's really in the hot seat because it's focused on getting a vaccine for the United States by January.
The hardest step, frankly, for access is to have the vaccines. And that's what we're, aiming to do.
So billions of dollars are going into figuring out these different vaccines. The U.S. has narrowed it down, he says, to 8 vaccine candidates. And then they've also been agreeing to manufacturing contracts. But in all of this, Slaoui says that the companies have agreed to share data from their research on these trials with the world. For him right now, his focus is if you can figure out the right combination of a vaccine approach, that is a game changer for all vaccines.
Frankly, it's the most valuable outcome next to, of course, the vaccine doses themselves, is what does it take to be protective? because then everybody can go and do that.
Alana, I understand that, but there's still the manufacturing part of this. The vaccine has to get made. And then how does distribution to what countries get prioritized?
I mean, if you look at the past, we shouldn't be surprised with what we're seeing, and which is that geopolitics is all over this. I mean, there's a global race for a vaccine and also for access to it. Countries are trying to do this for their populations. And what that means is countries that have more resources wind up getting the contracts first. I talked to Rajiv Venkaya. He's with the company Takeda about this, but he wears a lot of hats because he has worked in the U.S. government on pandemic preparedness and also in global vaccine access. He does worry about this trend with all these countries now that we're seeing line up for contracts.
My hope is that there will be very little time between when significant numbers of people, say in the U.S., get vaccine and when the rest of the world gets meaningful volumes of vaccine.
Are there efforts being made right now to broaden vaccine access when that vaccine is developed?
Yeah, absolutely. And so Venkaya is actually on the board of the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. It's a mouthful. It's called often referred to as CEPI. And they're working with the World Health Organization. The idea is to bring in as many countries as possible to lower resourced and higher resourced countries to come up with these contracts with manufacturers. And the idea is that 20% of populations would gain access to a vaccine. You know, not all countries have signed on to this, like the United States. It tends to be that the lower resource countries tend to bear the bigger burden of diseases of a pandemic for longer.
The World's Alana Gordon, thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
$3 billion, and that's billion with a B. That is the new estimate of how many animals were killed or displaced during the last Australian wildfire season. It was the worst fire season ever on record there.
It's hard to think of another event in the world in living memory that has killed or displaced that many animals.
That's World Wildlife Fund Australia CEO Dermot O'Gorman speaking to the Australian Broadcasting Corporation after the release of a new report detailing the fire's impact on wildlife, which the WWF funded. To come up with the $3 billion figure, scientists estimated the number of mammals, reptiles, birds, and frogs living in the area affected by the fires. That stretched out across some 44,000 square miles, an area nearly the size of Pennsylvania. Chris Dickman from the University of Sydney oversaw the new study. He told the ABC that the estimate for the 2019-2020 fire season is actually a conservative one.
One of the things that we really are very conscious of is that we haven't been able to include a lot of the different species groups. So fish, for example, we haven't had to get any good estimates of fish numbers. And yet fish are likely to be very heavily impacted by the aftermath effects of fires.
Dickman said some animals might have been able to outrun the fires, kangaroos and emus, for example, but koalas and other smaller animals were a different story.
I guess it's the less mobile species and the smaller ones that depend on the forest itself that are really in the firing line.
Dickman speaking there with the BBC. The fires also killed at least 34 people in Australia. Intense heat and dry conditions made for perfect bushfire conditions. Scientists say the record fire year was made 30% more likely because of climate change. Australian authorities are now reviewing the government's response to try to be better prepared to tackle next season's blazes. Politicians wooing Latino voters. That story is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Here's something to ponder to get your mind off the pandemic. 98 days until Americans elect the next president and Congress. It is the most unusual campaign season in our lifetimes. No rallies, no state fairs, no chance to meet, you know, the voters. The World's Daisy Contreras joins me now. She's the senior editor for our project Every 30 Seconds that looks at the young Latino vote in the U.S. Hey, Daisy.
Hey, Marco.
So this year's been a really tough one for campaigns in the middle of a pandemic. With all these limits on what they can do, what are the candidates actually doing to reach Latino voters?
I mean, right now, Marco, it's all about the virtual gatherings, social media, TV and radio ads. President Donald Trump's campaign is sticking with the Republican playbook and appealing to Latino business leaders. A group called Latinos for Trump is doing a lot of the outreach online. But there's one thing I want to highlight. A month ago, Trump signed an executive order forming a task force that focuses on educational and economic opportunities for Latinos. The focus was supposed to be the executive order, but a man named Robert Unanue took away that spotlight. He's the CEO of Goya Foods.
We're all truly blessed at the same time to have a leader like President Trump, who is a builder, And that's what my grandfather did. He came to this country to build.
Unanue's words angered many Latinos. And soon after, a call to boycott Goya products started trending on social media. And that was the chatter for a few days. Trump's campaign has used this as an opportunity to appeal to conservative Latinos. Trump and his daughter, Ivanka, posed with Goya products and posted those photos online. Then there were ads like this one in Florida, aimed at Puerto Rican voters.
Goya emplea a miles de personas aquí en la Florida y en la isla. Nos ponen el plato en la mesa, le dan beca a nuestros hijos, y apoyaron a Puerto Rico tras el huracán María. Pero ahora, los demócratas...
What is the ad saying, Daisy?
The ad says Goya helped Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria. It also says that's the taste Puerto Ricans love. And the ad blames Democrats for the Goya backlash.
So what has the Democratic presumptive nominee Joe Biden done to reach this voting bloc? I mean, especially after a Latino favorite, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, left the race.
Just as Trump has used the Goya fallout, Biden has used the administration's response to the pandemic. We know the pandemic has disproportionately impacted Latinos and African Americans when compared to other groups. His ads to Spanish-speaking Latino voters focus on that.
El agua, la luz, el celular, nuestra casa. Las cuentas no las detiene ni una pandemia. Y mientras se acumulan las cuentas, Trump continúa vendiendo cuentos.
This one says the pandemic does not stop the water, light, and cell phone bills. Those continue even while Trump continues to make up stories.
So, Daisy, it seems like both candidates are ramping up their efforts, but has it all been enough to get young Latino voters pumped up for November?
I've talked to a few people who are constantly polling Latino voters nationally, and most say Biden isn't doing enough. Many Latinos don't have a clear idea of who Biden is as a candidate or what he truly stands for. Now, even though this might be the case, this lack of enthusiasm, Biden has a lot of support from super PACs and other Latino-focused organizations that have endorsed him. The key is connecting with voters, and that's where he seems to be lacking.
And what about Trump? Who's supporting him?
Yeah, well, Trump needs to keep his conservative base happy. Roughly 30% of Latinos voted for the Republican candidate in 2016. And it's expected he will have roughly the same support. He needs those same voters to take key states like Florida, where we see a large Latino population. But let's not forget, there are also these new voters in the mix, young Latinos who'll be voting for the first time this year, and also eligible voters who didn't turn out to vote in previous elections. There's definitely an opportunity for both candidates to reach these voters and shift the results.
That was our Every 30 Seconds editor, Daisy Contreras. Daisy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Marco.
Our conversation about Latino voter outreach continues tomorrow online. Daisy will be speaking with Chuck Rocha, who is a top advisor for the Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign. Every 30 Seconds reporters Alejandra Martinez from KERA in Dallas and Michelle Marisco from KJZZ in Phoenix, they joined the discussion about what the Sanders campaign learned about Latino outreach. Email your questions to myworld@theworld.org. And join us tomorrow at noon Eastern at theworld.org. Around 650,000 people have died worldwide from the coronavirus. Behind each number is a story, and inside each story is a collection of families and friends in grief. But the way we mourn has been interrupted by the pandemic, and that could have some serious long-term impacts. Dr. Harvey Chachanov is a distinguished professor of psychiatry at the University of Manitoba and joins us from Winnipeg in Manitoba, Canada. Doctor, how has the grieving process been changing because of COVID-19? Like, how different is dying and grieving now than it was before the pandemic?
During the course of anticipating death, family members will usually sit vigil. They'll be there at the bedside for the most part, as much as they feel they can be. And they serve a variety of roles. They're there to advocate on behalf of the dying person that their pain is being well addressed. They're there to affirm the sense of personhood for that individual, and ultimately to be sure that that person doesn't die alone. During this time, family members aren't available to follow what I call a path of least regret. That is, they have questions that will then linger because they haven't been at the bedside, such as, were they in pain? Were they frightened? Were they alone at the time they died? And so when you change the course of dying and distort the course of dying, you can expect that there are going to be distortions in the course of how people go on to grieve.
How could these disruptions now in the grieving process impact people's mental health further down the line?
We can really expect that there is going to be a tsunami of suffering complicated bereavement may see us have more incidents of depression, post-traumatic stress, sleep disorders, anxiety.
So complicated bereavement, what is it exactly and how common is it? And do you think it's going to become more common?
Persistent complex bereavement disorder is actually something that is recognized formally by the DSM. It is something that sees individuals who manifest infinite longing for the deceased. There's a preoccupation with the circumstances of the deceased's death. There's an intense sorrow or distress that doesn't seem to improve over time. And such a diagnosis isn't made at least until 6 months following the death of that individual. The studies that I'm aware of suggest that complicated bereavement takes place anywhere from 7 to 10% of individuals who are bereft. I think given the distortions we're seeing in the dying process and the unavailability of community rituals of mourning, that if anything, we can expect that the prevalence of complex persistent bereavement disorder is going to go up.
So you're actually part of a group, Dr. Cole, the Canadian Grief Alliance, which has called on the Canadian government to form a national grief strategy. Why do you think this is something that needs to be dealt with at the national level?
Well, we think there needs to be a national approach so that all individuals who are grieving can have equal access. There are some particularly vulnerable populations. So people who are living in rural and remote areas, Indigenous people, immigrants, refugees, children, youth, Francophones, the availability of culturally sensitive grief supports simply is not there. And so we have called upon the government to make monies available to bolster currently existing services and to create expanded services for those in need, as well as to try and answer some of the questions regarding what will grief look like as a result of the pandemic.
Dr. Harvey Chachanov is a distinguished professor of psychiatry at the University of Manitoba. He's been speaking with us from Winnipeg. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome.
You're listening to The World. Life on the farm is tough right now. Immigrant workers have been hard hit by the virus, often working through lockdowns.
It was very hard situation. He was like 6 weeks in like coma.
Also coming up, if you're tired of staring out your window, we'll help you mix up your perspective ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. Earlier this month, during a televised speech, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan had a message for social media companies and the millions of Turks who use them.
Medya ve sosyal medya mecralarında yapıldığında da aynı sonuçla.
He said platforms like Twitter, YouTube, and Netflix are immoral, not fit for the Turkish nation. This was just a day or two after Erdogan's son-in-law announced the birth of his child on Twitter and was then allegedly insulted by social media users. In his speech, Erdogan vowed to crack down, and today Turkey's parliament began debating legislation that would do just that. Here's The World's Lydia Emanuelidou.
For the last few days, Elif Cansu İlhan has been on social media nonstop, trying to spread awareness about her government's latest efforts to crack down on the internet.
We created a hashtag and also other groups on the internet created some hashtags. One of them is Social Media Sesimiz, which means social media is our voice. And the other is Social Media Madokunma, which means don't touch my social media.
İlhan is an environmental activist based in Istanbul. She says social media is one of the few places where she's been able to do that activism, to scrutinize Turkey's government and its policies.
The traditional media is all pro-government, so they also will not publish what we say. So the social media is like our biggest campaign area, so it's very important for us.
İlhan's online activism puts her at risk. According to monitoring groups and media reports, Turkish authorities detain and prosecute thousands of people every year for criticizing the government online or posting things that the government has deemed illegal.
It is already stressful to use social media here, and everything will be even harder for us. Nothing is easy at the moment, but everything will be harder.
Harder because of the bill Turkey's parliament began debating today. It's widely expected to pass. If it does, big social media companies like Twitter and Facebook would have new obligations to hand over user data and take down content when the government demands it. The government would also have more power to block sites or shut them down entirely if companies don't comply. Turkish officials say these measures are necessary to stop illegal activity online. Critics say authorities could use them to uncover the identities of online critics and go after them, and to censor posts and websites they don't like. The Turkish government's online crackdown isn't new. It's been going on for more than a decade. But, says Didem Toli,
recently, the government has been trying to deepen their control on social media and the internet.
Toli is a researcher and reporter in Istanbul. She recently co-authored a report about freedom of expression in Turkey. It was published by Freedom House, a U.S.-based think tank. She says in Turkey, there's already widespread censorship of online websites and tools.
A lot of mainstream tools that someone who might be living in the U.S. can take for granted, these things have been banned in Turkey.
Wikipedia, for example, was banned for years.
Thousands and thousands of websites have been banned and made inaccessible, especially since 2016, since the failed military coup attempt.
More recently, she said, the Turkish government has been going after internet users who criticized its response to the coronavirus pandemic. She gave the example of a truck driver named Malik Ilmaz. After the Turkish government announced stay-at-home orders back in March, Ilmaz posted this video on the video sharing app TikTok. How would you suggest I stay home? He says in the video. I'm not retired or rich. If I don't work, I won't eat. This virus won't kill me. What will kill me is your system. Ilmaz was detained and interrogated over this post. And according to media reports, so were hundreds of others who criticized the government's coronavirus response online. Gurkan Osturan says all of this could get worse if the new legislation passes. He's an independent journalist and digital rights activist who's been monitoring and documenting the government's crackdown on online freedoms over the past decade.
In the last years, it has increased to levels unimaginable before.
At the same time, he says, the government has also tightened its grip on traditional media, a lot of which is state-run.
Since the media atmosphere in Turkey is almost completely suffocated by the government, a lot of Turkish people are expressing themselves on digital public spaces and getting their news, getting their independent news from digital platforms.
Osturan publishes his work on the news site he runs, called Dokuz 8 News. He uses social media platforms like Twitter to push out his stories. And he's worried about how the proposed measures would impact him and his readers. He says he's already noticing a chilling effect.
We are seeing that a lot of our friends are unfollowing, or they are reluctant to follow or read our news from our platform.
They're doing it out of fear, he said. Fear that he expects will only intensify if the proposal passes. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
I consider myself pretty lucky. My apartment faces a park, so when I'm not here on the radio, I've been spending a lot of time during the pandemic staring out my window. It's always fascinating, but there's a new online project that could let me change what I'm seeing. It's called Window Swap, and it lets you toggle through views of windows around the globe, from Israel to Brazil to France. This was the quarantine project of Sonali Ranjit and her husband, Vaishna Balasubramanian. They join us now from Singapore. So I've got a view of a park. There are kids playing hoops, a couple of people taking a Zoom karate class in the park. What do you see when you look out your own window?
Unfortunately, we look at the building across from us. There's nothing very interesting to look at.
I guess that's what gave us this idea in the first place. It's just this massive, tall apartment complex.
Explain how this all works. You log on to Window Swap, and then what happens?
It's a website with one giant button. So you hit the button, and then a new window literally opens with a 10-minute video of someone's view somewhere else in the world.
Yeah.
So you could end up looking through a window in Greece, looking at the pyramids in Egypt, or in Australia, or even Ghana.
And what are some of your favorite views that you've gotten, some of your favorite windows so far?
My favorite is this video of this little backyard in Hawaii, where you see a bunch of like chickens just running around. that's my personal favorite. And of course, then you have these a ton of videos with cats and dogs. There's one specific one from India with a little beagle in it, which I absolutely adore.
Sonali, is there a view from a window in the world that you haven't gotten yet that you really want to see?
Yeah, we saw this actually very funny tweet today where somebody asked NASA to take a video from one of their space stations. So we would love to see that.
Like that looking through the window of the world at Mars.
Or even down at Earth. That would be awesome.
Yeah.
Considering you started this because you were staring out your window in Singapore and seeing that blank apartment face across from you, how have these views helped you guys?
You realize that what you think is a boring view will be something that someone across the world will find endlessly fascinating and can stare at. As we've been downloading all the hundreds of videos that we get every day, we've gotten a chance to peep through different people's lives all around the world. Yeah. So it's sort of given us this understanding that even though we're so different in many ways, I think at home, we all have messy desks. We all have mismatched furniture. We all play interesting music. So it's sort of given us this sort of interesting worldview.
It creates that understanding, but it's also just soothing to click through these different window scenes. I know it's not exactly a substitute for actual travel, but could this fill a sort of wanderlust need that people have right now?
It is helping people that way a lot. Mm. It's helping us as well a lot just to see these places. And, you know, there's some hope, right? Maybe one day things will get better. Maybe it'll open up again. And maybe we'll, like it says on the site, maybe we'll get to travel this planet responsibly again.
Sonali Ranjit and her husband, Vaishna Balasubramanian, the co-creators of WindowSwap. It's an online project that lets you see the view out windows all over the globe. Thank you both very much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's clear that the pandemic is not impacting everyone equally. Those of us who can work from home in isolation should feel fortunate. For people who work on farms in this country, often immigrants, they've been pummeled by the virus. Earlier this year, the world's Monica Campbell reported on agricultural workers who were worried that they would not be protected from the virus. Here's Monica with an update.
Ernestina Mejia knew people were getting sick all around her. She said she heard coworkers in the bathroom at work coughing. Others whispered about colleagues looking feverish. Mejia wasn't surprised. She works at Primex Farms in California, north of L.A. She was sorting pistachios indoors on an assembly line. No masks, no gloves, no protection, she said. Then Mejia felt ill. She said she was out with COVID-19 for a month. Her husband and youngest daughter got sick too. So did 99 of Mejia's coworkers. One colleague died this month. From the start, the warnings were clear that farm workers would be at high risk for COVID-19. They work in cramped spaces, carpool, live in crowded homes, and they face an industry where labor standards are notoriously weak. Now, farm workers are among the hardest hit. But some workers are taking action.
Some breaking news this morning, taking you out live to workers who are picketing right now at Primex LLC.
Employees at Primex Farms, where Mejia works, went on strike recently, horrified at the number of coworkers getting infected, one out of every four. And the company wasn't talking to them about it, they said. During strike, Mejia was battling the virus at home, but she shared her colleagues' outrage. She said that Primex didn't provide masks, and when they did, they were for sale at the farm. They were selling the cloth masks for $8 each, Mejia says. She makes $13 an hour. In the end, she bought masks from a coworker for $4 each. Primex has stated that it did not sell masks and that it followed safety guidelines. Mejia says conditions at the farm are better since the strike. For instance, there are now staggered work breaks to avoid crowding. Yet Mejia still hears people coughing at work, and she knows her coworkers worry about missing a paycheck, maybe losing their jobs. Many immigrant workers are blocked from unemployment insurance. Some in Congress are pushing for broader federal help and more safety at farms. House Representative Jimmy Panetta of California wants to reimburse farms for personal protective equipment, or PPE.
I know that we're basically doing our job and making sure the funding is there so that they can have this PPE. And look, you want to make sure that these producers are requiring that their employees wear the PPE.
Yet there's still no national mandates to protect workers, just guidelines. That's a problem, says Armando Alenis of United Farm Workers.
They're recommendations, not requirements. And so therefore, that makes it difficult to enforce because they have no teeth.
Workers have paid a high price on the farms that have been slow to protect them. Anastasio Cruz harvested mushrooms, those white button kind, at a farm south of San Francisco. California declared its shelter-in-place order in mid-March, but Cruz continued to work indoors without a mask. He said he didn't worry. He thought nothing would happen. Then his body started aching. In April, he was hospitalized for 13 weeks. His daughter, Isela, sat next to Cruz while we talked over Zoom.
It was a very hard situation and a very slow progress. He was like 6 weeks, I believe, in like a coma, kind of.
Her dad spent 50 days on a ventilator. The day Cruz left the hospital, the nurses and staff cheered him on and videotaped it. He's still recuperating. Cruz pointed to the small tubes pushing oxygen through his nose. He doesn't expect to work for months at least. He also didn't want to name the mushroom farm where he worked, afraid it might hurt his chances of returning to his job. Speaking up can be risky.
Buenas tardes, mi nombre es María Irma Escobedo.
María Irma Escobedo also worked sorting pistachios at Primex Farms. This week, she was let go, along with at least 40 others. Many were active in the worker strike. Primex says the staffing cuts are based on usual seasonal reductions, but did not answer more detailed questions about that. Escobedo says it's clear retaliation for speaking out. She says she'll fight back, but right now she's not 100%.
Yo estuve en el hospital. Fueron días muy difíciles estar aquí en casa.
She tested positive for COVID in June and was hospitalized. She's still recovering. For The World, Monica Campbell.
One of the countries worst hit by COVID-19 is Yemen. The death rate there is 27%. That's about five times the global average. That's according to the group Med Global. Among the people who've died from the virus in Yemen are nearly 100 healthcare workers, including neurologist Yunus Anis, a professor at the University of Aden. We spoke with two Yemeni medical doctors who knew him well.
I was a student of Dr. Yunus Anis. He was one of my best teachers.
He teach me in medical college during my fourth and my sixth grade there.
Many doctors would refer to him the difficult neuro cases because of his expertise in neurology. I remember when I heard that he has passed away, I couldn't eat. I felt very, very sad.
Private hospitals during the pandemic closed their doors because they were afraid. There was no PPE, personal protecting equipment, like masks, gloves, or even gowns. But Dr. Yunus Anis was there, seeing patient, doing his best to protect himself. But unfortunately, at the end, he got infected and he intubated, and he was under a mechanical ventilator for about 3 days before he passed away.
We had lost a great man, a great scientist and professor. I hope that he rests in peace.
May Allah rest his soul in peace.
That was Mohammed Samir and Ayman Ali, medical doctors in Aden, Yemen, remembering their mentor, neurologist Yunus Anis, who died of COVID-19. Around 4 in 5 Canadians who've died from the coronavirus were residents at nursing homes. That's why the Canadian government put a virtual iron ring around these facilities for months. But now the homes are starting to open up again. Experts say confinement is doing more harm than good for many residents. Here's Anita Elash with more from Toronto.
Bonnie Wilson's 92-year-old mother, Elsie, moved into a nursing home in the Toronto area about 8 years ago. Elsie has dementia, but Bonnie says the last time she saw her in person, she was still the stylish and cheerful mom she's always known.
We were out at Valley Village with her hair done, her outfit, her earrings on, looking forward to participating in life.
That was March 3rd. The coronavirus outbreak hit Canada soon after. Nursing homes across the country were locked down and families were locked out.
Being isolated, not having any thing to look forward to, we had no end date in sight, certain things started to go awry.
The home was short-staffed. Wilson's mom was confined to her room and her problems with chronic pain got worse. The only way to see each other was through weekly video chats. Wilson says she watched helplessly as Elsie's physical and mental health deteriorated.
We're now at a point where she won't even go have a shower. She won't come out of her room. She won't get her hair washed. It's a combination, I believe, of her being in pain, feeling sick, and despondency. She doesn't want to live.
Most experts agree that locking down nursing homes at the start of the pandemic prevented many coronavirus deaths.
A week, a few weeks, it's a necessary evil.
Dr. Samir Sinha, director of geriatrics at Mount Sinai Medical Center in Toronto, supported the lockdown.
It's not going to be great, but, we have to weigh risks and benefits here.
But Sinha says regular family visits are often what keep nursing home residents mentally and physically healthy. And he says there's increasing evidence that keeping families apart for more than a few weeks is hurting residents.
We're seeing issues of undernourishment. We're seeing increasing issues of loneliness, depression that comes with that level of social isolation. And we're seeing worsening behavioral issues and people just deteriorating as a result.
Sinha says he wasn't surprised to learn that in one nursing home in France, infectious disease experts found that more people died of neglect during their confinement than from the coronavirus.
We may have the same numbers of people who may have died from loneliness, social isolation, dehydration and malnutrition as actually died, from COVID-19 itself.
Sinha is pushing provincial governments in Canada to allow nursing homes to open their doors to unlimited family visits. That's something they're reluctant to do. John Yip runs Kensington Gardens Nursing Home in downtown Toronto.
It's a very, very complicated situation. Tough, tough call. There's no easy answers here.
Like other nursing homes in Ontario, Kensington Gardens allowed the first indoor family visits last week. They're limited to once a week for up to 30 minutes, and everyone has to wear a mask and keep their distance. Bonnie Wilson, whose mom is in a different home, says she still won't be able to give her mom the care that she needs.
Under those rules, I can't help her with anything. Can't touch each other. I can't assist her. And I'm not able to do anything other than say hello. That's not enough when we have people that need attention.
And John Yip says he's also seen residents deteriorate mentally and physically during the lockdown. But for now, he doesn't want to risk another coronavirus outbreak. 8 residents died of COVID-19 in a single week, and his staff were forced to deal with the emergency situation. Yip says it was hard on everyone.
Our staff who don't bag bodies were bagging people they had cared for years, not in black body bags, but transparent plastic ones, and with a Sharpie would write on the bag the name, time, and roll that body bag through the unit. That sticks with me. Like there's trauma there.
Yip says that if there's even one new case at a nursing home, they'd be forced to confine residents and prevent any visits again. And he says no one wants to see that happen. For The World, Anita Elash, Toronto.
Nicole Flint is a member of Parliament in Australia. She represents the Liberal Party. As a woman in politics, she says she's had enough.
I've put up with a lot as a woman in politics. Police charged a creepy old man with stalking me.
My campaign office was vandalized, calling me a skank and a prostitute who charges $60 an hour.
Yesterday, in a video on Twitter, Flint listed past examples of misogyny she's faced in her career before sharing the most recent sexist remarks she's run into. Those, she says, came from columnist Peter Gerz in the Advertiser newspaper.
He criticized the fact that I wear stiletto heels, tight black pants that show my ankles, my pearl earrings, and he criticized my pearly smile.
In the column, Gerz went after Flint for presenting herself as, quote, a fashion plate. In a reply, MP Flint appears in the video proudly donning those heels, pants, and earrings. And she asks,
so, Mr. Gerz, what I want to know is, what should a woman in politics wear?
Flint then removes the black trench coat she's wearing to reveal one option.
How about a garbage bag to match your rubbish views?
She's wearing a garbage bag as a dress there. It's a clapback that brought praise from her fellow Aussie politicians.
Now we start off here with South Australian Labor Senator Marielle Smith. She said she didn't often agree with Nicole Flint, but she's in 100% agreement on this. There's no place for denigrating commentary on the appearance of women. Judge the policies, not the shoes.
One result of all this, the hashtag garbage like hers. It's got Aussie women sharing their own experiences with sexism. Nicole Flint told Sky News Australia that she hopes more comes into the light.
I think the more that we speak about it, I hope the less common it will become. And I honestly think that this is how we'll see this sort of behaviour stamped out eventually.
As for Peter Gerz, he also hosts a radio show on ABC Radio Adelaide.
Hi.
Gerz did his three-hour show today in Australia, but did not comment on Flint's now viral video. And that's where we leave you on this Tuesday, but connect with us anytime online. You can find us at theworld.org, where you can explore our reporting, subscribe to our daily newsletter, and connect with our team of journalists. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.